Welcome to our Solid Waste Working Group here. Again, today's meeting is really just an informational meeting because a number of issues have arisen among members and kind of the solid waste community around the state. So we wanted to have an opportunity to just have an informational hearing on Representative Bunn's bill, and she's done a tremendous job doing a lot of research on this as well. I think before we take up the bill, I would just like to see if perhaps Representative Scalzi has read over the minutes. Are there any additions, corrections? Not, the minutes are approved as read. And furthermore, with regard to our informational meeting today, what most of the questions have come up, it seems to be regarding what broader ramifications of this bill might be around the state, we will focus a little bit more on some of the issues of how this will affect other members, and not so much on the direct influence on, you know, the Washington County in particular, because we have had quite a bit of testimony on that in the other committees. So I think members have had an opportunity to hear quite a bit of that, but there are some other points of view that have not been brought up. So we're going to focus a little bit more on some of the points of view that we haven't heard from and a little bit less on the ones that we have. And unfortunately today, the weather decided to give us April Fool's a day early, and so a number of the people from rural Minnesota that had intended to be here to testify today were not able to come, so we will have people reading letters from them, which is never quite as interesting as having the actual testifiers here. However, there are a number of people from many sectors that will be able to answer questions about this process as it goes on beyond the immediate scope of some of the things in Washington County. I think at this point, since you appear to be ready, Representative Bunn, if you would like to summarize your bill a little bit and just kind of give us some direction as to where you're headed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Saylor and Representative Saylor. I want to thank you and your committee for having this opportunity to further discuss this legislation. It's always important to vet things as fully as possible, and that the result of these kinds of conversations usually leads to better legislation. So I'd be glad to have this conversation today. In terms of what I'm going to do is, I think all of you except maybe Representative Hortman have heard this in a committee or two already. I think I'm correct on that. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time going over the details of the bill, but I'm going to briefly summarize it. And then I'm going to move directly to kind of the three kind of global issues we want to help address today and that seem to be of concern to folks. The first of those global issues is, you know, the validity of this approach of doing a tritium test as a first initial screening test for this type of siting. Secondly, what this may add to cost of the evaluation of potential sites for landfills. And thirdly, the issue of how to what extent this might constrain options for where to site landfills in the future, which seem to be the questions of most concern to the counties throughout the state, solid waste administrators, et cetera, which prompted us wanting to have this discussion today. In terms of the bill itself, it contains a couple different components. I'm just going to go by the key paragraphs in it, starting with paragraph A, basically sets up this tritium test. For those of you who may have saw the first version of this bill, it was one paragraph, and basically the idea was to try to identify those areas that, based on geologic hydrologic conditions, were considered to be highly sensitive to groundwater contamination. But because not all portions of the state have that type of analysis done and mapping done of those sensitivity maps, we had to come up with a more precise criteria for what is highly sensitive. Moreover, even where those maps existed, they were considered kind of a broad sweep and weren't site-specific, and we wanted to make sure we had a site-specific criteria. So this tritium testing was a way to do this. Tritium was a result of a nuclear testing in the 1950s, and it turns out it, and there's a few other chemicals for which this is true as well, but it turns out to be a good marker for the age of water. In any event, this testing would require that up to four drillings would have to occur at two different depths and samples taken from the groundwater in subject conditions to this test. So in paragraph B would set a level above which if tritium comes in above 5 tritium units or greater, then this site would not be viewed, would not be given its permit to site a landfill, except unless you move to paragraph C, where even if the test comes out above 5 units of tritium, that the applicant could request that at the discretion of the commissioner that other types of scientifically valid documentation be provided related to the groundwater conditions at that site. And if after reviewing this, not only the tritium test and the additional testing data, any other data pertaining to the site susceptibility to groundwater contamination could also be taken into account. So that's non-chemistry data, related data, anything related to the groundwater situation could be taken into account. Then on the back side on page on paragraph C, which is line 188.6, early on, another number of issues were relayed. We intended from the outset to have the supply only to the siting of new landfills in the state. And so we made that very clear in this paragraph by excluding existing landfills, extensions to existing landfills, and even extensions that are not directly contiguous on that landfill site. To make sure we covered some cases that were brought to our attention about, I'm on paragraph E there. I forgot we added paragraph D. Paragraph D, I will let my expert speak to in a minute, is in there because, in fact, the appropriate tritium level can change over time. So I was just then referring to paragraph D in terms of not extending this legislation to existing landfills or expansion of existing landfills, or those that take a new type of waste. And then finally, paragraph F would say that those disposal facilities accepting industrial waste would be subject to the same rules that apply to municipal solid waste currently. So those are the components of the legislation. After the early presentation of the legislation, a number of folks responded to the legislation. Waste Management wrote two memos, and then also the PCA wrote a memo to me, both of which highlighted some concerns about the validity of the approach of the tritium test, and also about what this might do to constrain where landfills were sited. We took that into consideration. The geologist experts who had been advising us and working with us at the Minnesota Geological Survey, we went over that with them and also with some health research staff. And the assistant associate director of the Geological Survey wrote this memo in response. So you have in your packet this memo, which is titled, it says Minnesota Geological Survey at the top. Essentially, in this memo, they address those issues that were raised in those two documents. Essentially, at the outset, first of all, with further looking at Bob Tipping, who's giving us there, in terms of the literature on tritium testing and the science of it, that we continue to feel very confident that this is an appropriate way to look at this issue. But want to clarify and be very specific about that this does not promote tritium testing as a replacement for existing practices and procedures, but an additional screening tool to prevent suspensive sites from going forward in the process. And moreover, that the bill, as I said in paragraph C, allows even those sites that initially might fail the test to be further investigated by any means, and that the permit applicant can submit further evidence related to the groundwater conditions, even if the tritium test might lead to false conclusions at the outset. So this is just an initial screen, and the rules and practices we already have would then continue to come into play after that point. Also, there was some issues raised about what this would do in terms of limiting where it could go, and that's responded to primarily on the second page because MPCA had raised that with a few basic pieces of information and facts as to why the scientists working on this disagree with what the MPCA memo said, and that and this will come up later in the presentation, but essentially there's 3 points there, 1, 2, and 3. I just suggest that you take a look at those and read them, but we feel, again, firmly that there are extensive areas throughout Minnesota that, in fact, would fall under 5 units of tritium, and that there be many and abundant areas to site new landfills as a result of that. So that's on the issue of the validity of the approach and the test. The issue about cost raise, there's a couple different types of costs involved. First of all, the testing itself. The testing itself would require 4 tests of enriched tritium, and that would be $175 each, so it'd be 4 times $175, roughly. The cation and anion test is a combined test of $50 each, so that would be 50 times 4. And then, of course, the big cost that might be involved was the issue of drilling, which Wasteman and others mentioned as a possibility in terms of how it would affect cost. If one looks at the rules we already have in Minnesota for both industrial and particularly for municipal solid waste sites, many, many borings already have to be drilled for these sites under the current rules. So you already have drill rigs out, you're already drilling borings, 50 feet below the elevation of the proposed facility in the case of an industrial facility. So the big fixed cost of having the drilling rigs there and that kind of fixed cost would already be incurred under current situation. It is true that with this tritium test, they would have to be wells and not just boring. So they would have to be encased. And so that would add to the cost of up to 4 of these borings. If you look at the rules for municipal solid waste, I mean, there can be for a multi, 50-acre site, there's like many borings, 50 borings that are done. So it's only up to 4 of these that with this additional casing would be required. I say up to 4 because if they don't hit, don't hit bedrock in 150 feet, they're not doing any other borings, and then it's okay, the site passes, you don't have to do any tritium testing. So the good chunk of the state, that would be the case if no further testing would be done whatsoever. It would meet the requirements of this legislation. So my suggestion here would be that given the borings already required under both industrial and municipal solid waste rules currently, that the drilling equipment is already there, you would have to go somewhat deeper, potentially, in some instances, for the tritium testing that's required in this legislation, but that it would not be unduly burdensome additional costs given the fixed costs that are being incurred. Finally, we want to move to this issue that I began to speak of in terms of the page 2 of that memo, in terms of the issue of what portions of our state are still available that we would expect to be under this 5 tritium level. And for this, and also for further clarification of why 5 units, I'm going to refer to our expert today, and he has a PowerPoint presentation to share with you.
Thank you, Representative Fun. So, welcome, Mr. Bob Tipping from the Minnesota Geological Survey, correct?
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'd like to do is to show you some examples of tritium as it's used in groundwater sensitivity mapping around the state and how it compares with the geologic mapping that's done in those sites also. The point being is that the sensitivity maps that were in the original bill were recognized as a screening tool, and one of the tools that we use to help evaluate those maps are tritium. And so I wanted to show you some examples of how tritium levels and tritium measurements compare with a sensitivity map. What I'm showing you here, as you can see on the screen, is a really broad brush look at the geology of Minnesota. So essentially the yellow on here are sand bodies that are at the land surface, or sandy materials, and the green or everything else that's not sand. So the first pass with regard to this bill, the materials that are shown in yellow would be your uppermost sand aquifers and would not be ideal sites based on this site. Everywhere in this yellow, if you had a well, you'd probably expect to find live tritium at that site. Alternatively, the green, the non-sandy material, again, has aquifers that are either buried at the surface, either close to land surface, or deeper. These green materials are typically glacial till or clay material, but not in all cases. But I'll show you some more examples of those. This slide here is a picture of a statewide groundwater sensitivity map that was done in 1989 by Eric Forscher at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And basically, there's other characteristics involved besides just what the material is. It includes depth for water. It also includes the hydraulic characteristics of the soils. He kind of put all these pieces together and came up with this map, hot colors being sensitive to groundwater pollution, the cooler colors being less sensitive. And if you compare the two, they're very similar. They show similar patterns, with hot colors, again, corresponding to the sand bodies that you saw in the previous slide. What I want to do is to show you some more specific examples. This map is a broad brush look at sensitivity in groundwater. What we're trying to do in this project, in the program of the county atlas and the regional assessments that you see here, is to provide more detailed mapping. And what I'd like to look at specifically are Polk County Geologic Atlas, Goodhue County, and portions of the South Red River Valley to look at some of the examples, again, of how tritium samples compare with the geology that was mapped with regard to pollution sensitivity. So starting with Polk, here's the map. There's a lot of information on here, but I want to focus on one particular part of it. Down here, see if I can show this here. Here's Polk County. And if you can see that on the screen, there's sort of a blue band in here in the center section. This would be low permeability material at the land surface. And again, this even shows up on a broad statewide map. If we look at it in more detail, this white area in here would represent that till. These gray areas on either side of the county to the east and to the west represent sand at the land surface. So they correspond to the yellow that you saw on that original map. But this center area, till, now when we map it in more detail, we see an example of where there are aquifers that are up near the land surface but not quite there. So they wouldn't show up in a regional map, a statewide map, but they show up when we start doing more detailed mapping. And that's what you're seeing in here. And I want to zoom in on one particular area. What we're looking at are aquifers now that are just below the land surface that have some sort of protective cover on top. And so they're mapped in green. The colors, again, the hotter colors represent areas that are more sensitive to groundwater pollution. The green areas that are less sensitive. And if you look on here, there are several dots that represent tritium samples. In this case, these red dots, this one right here, represents a well that was sampled that had more than 10 tritium units in it. These blue dots down here are all wells that had less than detection tritium. So in other words, they had no detectable tritium in them. In this case, and granted this is picking an ideal situation, is where tritium just corresponds very well with what was mapped in terms of pollution sensitivity. This particular case here, this well has live tritium. It also has a lack of thick till cover on top of it. I should make the point that all these tritium samples and the way the sensitivity mapping is done is based on the assumption that groundwater is essentially moving down vertically. We recognize that there are going to be situations, and we'll look at one in just a second, where you could have live tritium from water that's moved from off the site. And so we want to be clear on that. In this case here, though, it corresponds with what's on top of the well, corresponds very well with live tritium being either in the well or not in the well. Goodhue County, down in southeastern Minnesota.
Put the summary in, and he can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but early on, Dale Sutterholm, his colleague, who was one of the leads on this as well, but who's out of town last weekend today, looked at this particular county, and if you look at all the tritium testing throughout this county, he found over 65%, I believe, of the county had tritium levels, would be expected to have tritium levels less than one. So over 65% of that county would be available for, you know, would pass the criteria for landfill selection for this county.
Right. This map here, this white area again, in a lot of these areas, there are wells that may be in deeper aquifers. We would expect that the wells in this area also be no detectable tritium. What I've shown in this example, in this area that's mapped in green, these would be the uppermost aquifers that are not right at the land surface. So there are still no cases where there are these wells that have no detectable tritium in them. Okay. Southeastern Minnesota is an area that's been mapped pretty extensively in terms of bedrock geology, superficial geology, and in groundwater sensitivity. And I want to look at an example of Goodhue County. If we go back to the statewide map, here's Goodhue County right here. Essentially, how hot colors, if we look at that map in more detail, which is the next slide, you see that there's portions in the southwestern corner of Goodspeed County that are mapped as green in their pollution sensitivity. And so what I want to do is take a closer look at that one. This is a situation where the geology is a little bit different. In Polk County, we're looking at glacial sediments, and here we're looking at bedrock aquifers. The uppermost aquifer in this case is the Galena Formation. It's a limestone. It has wells in it that are completed at depths maybe from anywhere from 50 to 150 feet. And what you want to look at on this slide are these blue circles and these other colored circles here, disregarding the other symbols for the time being. Each of these symbols in here would be the same color scheme that you saw previously. A blue circle means no detectable tritium in that well. This would be the uppermost aquifer. In the same unit, we're seeing live tritium in some of these wells. Here's a red one. This would be a well that has greater than 10 tritium units. Here's another one with greater than 10 tritium units. What we're seeing are situations where that uppermost aquifer in certain places would pass this test and other places it wouldn't. Recognizing that this is a bedrock aquifer, one typical or common explanation is we have lateral flow in these aquifers. It can move very quickly. We know that there's vertical joints in these aquifers also. These are the complicating situations that make that vertical flow of groundwater more complicated. And this is the purpose for paragraph C, to be able to demonstrate why it is that there's live tritium in this setting as opposed to not. Okay. So if we go back to this particular scene here, the areas that would qualify for siting just based on tritium alone would be probably limited exclusively to the southwestern corner of the county. In terms of area, we're probably looking at about a third of that county. Once the tritium samples were done and a site has been chosen, this is the type of information that helps refine that choice. Out of this top number of wells, I think there were 17 wells that were finished in a lower aquifer that are below this green unit here, not that upper unit I was just referring to. Most of those wells, I would say 80% of those wells had no detectable tritium. In this particular one, we're probably looking at 50% of the wells that were sampled in this uppermost bedrock aquifer had no detectable tritium.
Mm-hmm. Just again to put this in the context and from moving quickly, this whole southeastern portion of Minnesota, so you see on the whole statewide map, is in the hot colors, meaning it's very sandy, and therefore it's very likely to test positive for tritium in these areas. But what we're seeing is even a county in one of the hottest regions, you know, in terms of the hot colors, meaning where we have sandy conditions, very likely to test for tritium. Even in that county, we're showing by the detailed tritium testing for that county that a third of that county would probably be past the test involved in this legislation and be suitable for siting landfills. So even in an area of the state that's most likely to be at risk for high-sensitive ground characterization, most likely to test high for tritium, we have a large portion of the county that's suitable for siting landfills, even in this region.
The last one I wanted to look at, one of the letters that came in were from Polk County, so up in the Red River Valley, and I wanted to show you some data from there. This is a regional assessment, so this is different than the county atlases. This mapping would be more similar to the broad brush mapping you saw on that statewide map. So I think what's interesting here, again, is to look at the tritium values in this particular site. So where are we? In this state map, again, we're up here in the northern part of the Red River Valley, or excuse me, central part of the Red River Valley. We're going to look in detail in this area right here. It may be difficult for you to see the numbers, but the color schemes are the same again. The left-hand numbers in this case are depth. And I think what's important here to recognize, this are the lake sediments here of Lake Agassiz. So there's very clay sediments, and most of these wells are finished below that. This one's 67 feet deep. It has no detectable tritium. This one's 317 feet deep, so it's considerably deeper, no detectable tritium. Then we go up into this area, and we've got a 35-foot well that has detectable tritium, and then a 61-foot well next to it that has no detectable tritium. The value that we see in these tests is that they do give us site-specific information that is a nice addition to any additional work that goes on there. This map represents some broad brush geologic mapping that doesn't really tell you much about the actual connection between the atmosphere and the aquifers in this setting. Whereas tritium, as an additional tool to use to evaluate these sites, in this case, shows up in this corner that there is a good connection between the atmosphere and the shallow aquifer in this case, sand body of 35 feet deep, but no detectable tritium at a depth of 61 feet. So again, the use of this tool, we believe, is a useful addition to a site assessment, specifically site-specific assessment. I did want to show you one more slide here. This one, I don't know if it's on the printout that you received or not. Some of the concern about tritium and its measurement of 5 tritium units versus 10 tritium units versus 15 or 3 or 6. One of the things that tritium does is it's kind of like tracking the weather. You can take a daily temperature, which could vary considerably, but over time these measurements seem to follow a reasonable trend. It's not a hard and fast number, and we recognize that. What you're looking at here is a chart of tritium concentrations in Ottawa, Canada, that is used as a surrogate for Minnesota in terms of the level of atmospheric tritium. And what you're seeing, as was mentioned before, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, there was a peak in atmospheric testing nuclear weapons. We recognize that peak now on tritium samples as having concentrations maybe on the order of 20 to 30 to 40 tritium units. Current atmospheric concentrations are estimated in Minnesota to be between 8 and 12 tritium units. When this tool was first started being used, they were higher, as you see back here in the late 80s and early 90s. The number 10 for tritium units was originally used to identify water that was predominantly recent, which meant that we recognize all these waters are mixtures of recent water and older water come together, but if it was above 10, that was considered to be recent water, mostly water that has entered the ground since the 19, probably since the last, well, in that case, I think they used the definition of the last 10 years. What's changed, however, is that atmospheric concentration has dropped. We're still bouncing around, but we're somewhere in the range of 8 to 12 tritium units. Tritium has a half-life of 12 years. So if water entered the ground now with 12 tritium units, or excuse me, let's take 10 tritium units, in 12 years, the concentration of that water under ideal conditions would have a tritium concentration of 5 tritium units. So the number of 5 is not arbitrary in terms of determining how much tritium is in the water. We recognize that any detectable tritium in the water indicates that there's been some contact of water, some portion of that water, with the atmosphere within the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, Madam Chair, the main goal here was to represent in some detail, first of all, the statewide map that, based on what we know on the very broad brush statewide, you saw in the green there the huge areas that are non-sandy. The sandy areas we would expect to very likely fail this tritium test. But as you saw, those were a small portion of the state, the yellow areas. The green areas were areas that very possibly could pass this criteria. And then we showed in detail for those counties of sampling counties in three very different regions of the state, including the area most likely to fail this test, the southeast, to show that even within each of those three counties, based on actual tritium testing on the ground in those counties, that's quite recent, that there are significant and plenty of areas that landfill siting could go forward. So a couple of things to add in conclusion is, first of all, we did also receive the end of last week some comments from the DNR on the technical issues in the legislation. We have had discussions about their comments. They had some suggested changes in terms of how to phrase the cation and anion testing portions of it, which we have now written up some language to address. They also had some other technical comments, and we're also working on incorporating those in the bill as well. And so we will for sure later this week have at least a minimum a technical amendment to include some of the good suggestions that the Department of Natural Resources shared with us. So those are the main things. We'd be glad to take questions now from members of the committee.
Representative Gardner.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a couple, but maybe I'll just start with one. For Mr. Tipping, does the PCA use your data in the permitting process? And one thing I've noticed with the drinking water stuff I've been working on is that there hasn't been like a groundwater information standard among agencies. There's not data sharing. You know, does the PCA pull out a map and say, oh, you know what, they're putting this in a hot spot and the MGS has a map already that shows that this is highly sensitive, blah, blah, blah.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not familiar with their PCA procedures. I know that they consider groundwater sensitivity in their guidelines, but whether they're pulling out particular maps, I don't know.
I had a
Representative Gardner.
A follow-up. I You know, I think one reason there's some scratching of heads and things like that is that, you know, you're asking essentially lay people to figure out whether, you know, the tritium test or a widget test or whatever test is the right way, and I don't really have the answer for that, and you have some compelling information that shows that it might be. The original bill had something that was sort of more idiot-proof for us lay people, which said something like that we will not cite landfills in areas that are considered highly sensitive, and I assume that was based on some definition that you guys might have. I don't know. And, you know, how can we help boil us down a little bit so that we can let the technical folks do the technical part and you boil it down to areas where we can just say, all right, no landfills in this area. That is the case in Minnesota rules for MSW. It says karst areas are, you know, off limits, and that's kind of simple. It's easy to do, but this is just harder for us to plow through, and I'm just worried there's going to have to be a lot of time on the floor where people are scratching their heads going, is this the right test? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, we recognize that the original maps that were in the first bill, again, were not site-specific and are not meant to be site-specific. In any investigation that's done of a site, the most conclusive connection you can make between the land surface and the aquifer is to do some sort of trace. If you put something in the ground and you saw it come out somewhere else and you knew when it went in the ground, then you would have a definite connection established between the land surface and that aquifer as you can get. This includes groundwater models, it includes pump tests, includes any other sort of test that you could devise. A physical trace is the best way to do that. Tritium is essentially a trace of the atmosphere. It's a water molecule. It's a hydrogen isotope, so it's part of the water molecule. It shows up, it moves as water does. The difficulty, and I think in getting our thoughts around this use of tritium, is that we concentrate on the levels of tritium that are in the water. Detectable tritium has a half-life, which means that over time it disappears. So in that way, it's a nice clock. If the atmosphere has a certain amount of tritium in it and we find tritium in the water, we know that there's a connection between the atmosphere and the water. So essentially, if I can boil it down, tritium is a trace. It's a trace from the land surface to the aquifer. I don't know if that helps or not. But then again, the only way that we can evaluate sensitivity in terms of the geologic mapping is to try to use a tool like that. And the use of tritium is a way to link this current bill's language back to the intent, I think, of the original bill, which was to come up with a way to evaluate groundwater sensitivity, in this case in a site-specific way.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions? If not, I did have one for you, Mr. Tipping. Referring to the maps from your PowerPoint, the ones where you had highlighted different locations around the state, I'm noticing, maybe if I just point those, exactly. Have you just chosen those particular areas to highlight for regional and county geologic atlases, or are there the white areas is what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. Do those have atlases, or are they just not showing up on this map?
No, this is the current state of work that's going on in this program. And most of the work right now is actually in the blue type of maps. And what you look over there on the right-hand side, there's a complete. That's where these maps are entirely done. And then there's sort of a lighter blue, which means that it's in progress, or the geology is completed, and the second part, the groundwater part, is in progress. And then the lightest blue shows that it's just still in progress. These are the only areas that county atlases have been mapped. The white areas do not have these maps.
Thank you, Mr. Tipping. Do you have any projection for when you might have that information completed for the other parts of the state?
The Atlas program, my colleague Dale could speak much better to this than I can, but essentially we work in a situation of a cost-sharing agreement with the counties. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the ways that these county atlases are prioritized are by people's interest and then their ability to pay. It's a sliding scale based on whether or not someone has enough money in their county and their tax base to afford it. But essentially, we work out an agreement with the county to go and set up to do these atlases. That's why you can see that some of these are kind of spotted around. All the current work going right now, there's one in Carlton, Benton, Chisago, McCloud, McLeod, and Carver counties. Those are all based on meeting with the county and agreeing to do a map there. So we don't have a systematic way, I guess, to answer your question of going area by area to do additional mapping, new mapping.
Thank you, Mr. Titting. I do have one additional question. Do you have any sense of what the cost is when you mentioned cost sharing between the counties for this? What would be the typical cost to a county that was entering into that mapping relationship with you?
Madam Chair, again, someone in the audience can correct me better from the DNR. I think that the low end of that is probably $30,000 over a 2 to 3 year period. And then up to, I think, up to 90. 180 would be the maximum level that I believe the county's contribution. 108, excuse me, 108. So we're going, is 30? 50-50. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Sidney. Mm-hmm. Are there any additional questions of this testifier? Representative Bunn.
To your one question back in terms of this map and when the white areas in the map, one reason we gave those broad sweeping maps at the outset was because we knew that there was limited data on these other areas. It is true, as you said, that roughly a lot of these blue areas, they were some of the first ones studied because they are the ones that were thought to be very highly sensitive. So there was some impetus by those counties to look into it further, particularly the southeastern ones. And so as if you go back to those first two maps in terms of the broader brushes and sensitivity, these areas in white would be expected, we would think, based on what we know, to have good portions of them that wouldn't be sensitive to groundwater contamination.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. If there are no further questions, thank you. And I think we have Dan, is it Kilo or Kylo?
Are you going to do that now on the specific on the west? Dan is to the issue of the particular issue in Washington
okay.
County, so if you want to hold that off to Dan, he can wait.
Thank you, Representative Bunn. That would be great. I would do that. Then Annalie Garlitz from AMC, Association of Minnesota Counties, and I think Randy Kaiser were wanting to address the issue together.
Excuse me, Madam Chair,
yes,
I could leave this machine up here, too, if anybody else has something you need to show on the screen. I didn't know.
Okay. Thank you. I don't know. No one has.
No? Leave it up.
Yeah, we haven't heard from anyone else yet. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Garlitz. On behalf of AMC, go ahead and proceed with your testimony. I believe you are also going to be bringing some of the remarks from some of the outstate folks who, due to the weather, were not able to be here today. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I will, as the Chair said, I will also be reading some comments from members of the Solid Waste Administrators Association, and I think for the purposes of our testimony, I'll have Mr. Kaiser go first with the reading of some of these letters. As noted, we had several members of the Solid Waste Administrators Association who did want to come from Polk County, Otter Tail County, Olmsted County, as well as Sherburne County even was going to try to make it, and it just was too difficult this evening. So we do have some letters that we will be reading.
Thanks, Annalie, Madam Chair, members of the committee. That's First of all, I'm going to read it from Mike.
Okay. Mr. Kyler, could you please just state your name for the record, please? Thank you.
Randy Kaiser. I'm with Hennepin County Environmental Services. And the first one I'm going to read is from Mr. Mike Hanen, who's the director of the Department of Solid Waste for Otterfield County, the Solid Waste Officer. Mike has, I'm not sure how many years of experience, I know at least 20, so he's been around for a long time and a pretty much an expert in solid waste issues. And I'll just read the letter as he sent it in. Dear Representative Saylor, it is my understanding the Joint Committee, Solid Waste Recycling and Resource Conservation Working Group, will be meeting soon to discuss various solid waste and environment-related legislation. One of the bills that you may be discussing is House File 3997, offered by Representative Julie Bunn. I applaud Representative Bunn's efforts to protect the state of Minnesota's water resources and firmly believe that each and every one of us working in the solid waste industry have an equal interest in protecting Minnesota's water resources. However, I am concerned that this bill, as drafted, has not been afforded the proper opportunity for discussion and scrutiny within the hydrological and geological scientific community. I am concerned that choosing just one parameter, tritium, by which to determine the suitability of siting all future landfills would be a mistake without considerable scrutiny and discussion by the scientific community. As you all know, the state of Minnesota has a very extensive set of statutes and rules which apply to the siting, construction, and operation of landfills in the state of Minnesota. The current statutes and rules were adopted in 1988 and have been modified on limited occasions since that time. While Representative Bunn brings to light a significant concern regarding the protection of Minnesota's water resources, it would be a mistake to address landfills in general with an overly simplistic approach without first researching, evaluating, and providing detailed scientific documentation justifying that such an approach is both the most prudent and the most effective method of addressing landfill siting and the protection of Minnesota's water resources. It is my understanding that jointly the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Solid Waste Administrators Association have addressed a letter to Representative Bunn indicating similar concerns as well as indicating the need for detailed scientific study and evaluation. I believe that this joint letter indicates clearly the potentially complexity of this issue as well as the potentially significant financial ramifications. It would seem that, considering these potential ramifications, that detailed scientific scrutiny is both warranted and necessary. In closing, I would like to restate the fact that I applaud the efforts of both Representative Bunn and the Joint Committee, Solid Waste Recycling Resource Conservation Working Group, for your efforts toward improving and protecting Minnesota's resources, especially its water resources, and look forward to continuing to address these issues through future studies and discussions. Sincerely, Michael Hanen, Director, Otterfield Department of Solid Waste.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser, and I don't imagine it would be very useful for any questions directed to Mr. Hanen to go through you. I don't know if you're prepared to answer questions to him, but at any rate, perhaps as testimony proceeds, if there are some other questions that come up regarding some of the county issues, perhaps we could direct them to you.
Sure, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to try.
Madam Chair, the next letter that I have is
Ms. Garlitz.
Thank you. A letter sent from John Steiner in Polk County, who is the past president of the Minnesota Solid Waste Administrators Association, and he's also the District 2 representative for the Executive Board. John Steiner states that he has reviewed the bill, and as he interprets the bill, it becomes obvious that the intent of the proposed language is to provide for the additional protection of water quality found in Minnesota's aquifers. And he states that the association shares that goal as well. Counties have long been concerned with the quality of our surface and groundwater resources, as we too represent those residents who depend upon the natural resources. This shared concern can be evidenced by our strong historical support for these types of legislative initiatives and state programs. Most recently, last session included the electronic waste bill and the waste pesticide bill, both of which reduce the incentive for illegal disposal and reduce toxicity to landfills. Though your bill exempts landfills in operation currently, including their expansion, there is no mention of the fate of those landfills when they ultimately either must re-permit or must be replaced upon reaching their final capacity. Also of great concern is how the amount or prevalence of tritium in the groundwater may have on the fate of an individual landfill, either existing or proposed. Quite honestly, this is a new standard for landfill evaluation, one for which counties have not been provided the necessary time to evaluate its effectiveness in determining landfill siting. We have been provided no technical data, involved in any stakeholder process, nor given any advance warning that such a proposal was under consideration. Our responsibility to our residents demands that we be afforded the opportunity to assess the ramifications of such drastic measures before we support the inclusion of this criterion to the landfill permitting process as proposed in the bill. Therefore, taking into account your intention to pass additional standards which would further protect the groundwater beyond its current practice and our need to diligently and deliberately review any proposed standards which may have the potential to adversely impact our residents, I offer the following solutions. One, the passage of a moratorium not to exceed 2 years on the siting of any new unlined landfill which would accept industrial waste in exempting demolition debris facilities which accept inert materials such as wood, brick, concrete, etc. Two, the formation of a legislative stakeholder group such as the one formed for e-waste to review your proposed criterion and or other measures which would provide a similar level of groundwater protection. And three, formulate a stakeholder recommendation to be implemented prior to the sunset of the moratorium. As I stated earlier, counties share your goal of protecting the valuable water resources of Minnesota. We would welcome the opportunity to work with you or any resulting stakeholder group to determine the best available method to further protect our groundwater. However, until ample time and information is made available to counties to determine the potential impact of such a measure as called for in your bill, we are unable to support it. The last result we wish to see come from the passage of any bill designed to protect the environment is one which creates more incentive for illegal dumping. Should we be unable to replace existing landfills when final capacity is reached, or be unable to site any new landfills where the need exists and environmental protection is achieved, the only options then available to residents in these areas are either illegal disposal or payment of high transportation costs to reach distant markets. This is an ongoing battle that counties deal with on a regular basis, and we are deeply concerned that this bill may inadvertently worsen that situation. I may be reached at the phone numbers and the email address above. John Fink, Representative Bunn, for the consideration of the position, the intentions, and the request. And John writes that he appreciates the efforts made to revise the bill into its current format in order to address the concerns and hope that Representative Bunn will continue to work with us to find an equitable solution to meet our satisfaction. And it's signed John Steiner, Polk County Solid Waste Administrator. Sorry, just hang on. And I would just like to echo, AMC also has a letter that we've distributed. And to be honest, I will not read that letter out loud to everybody since you do have it there and I'm sitting right here. One of the biggest concerns that AMC has is that we would also like, just as Mr. Steiner stated in his letter, we would also like some more time to take all of the different things into consideration. And I think it was in the letter that Mike Keenan wrote from Otter Tail County when he noted that the rules were created in the late 80s and perhaps it would be time to revisit those rules, and that would be something that AMC and I know the Solid Waste Administrators Association would also support. And so we're just asking for more time to go through this decision-making process because counties do offer and provide funding for the solid waste service that we offer, and if certain pieces of the bill were to go through, we are concerned that it could result in a higher cost to offer those services to residents, one of which counties may not choose to be active in the future. And I know Mr. Kaiser might be able to address some of those concerns a little bit more from some of the information from the Solid Waste Administrators.
Thank you. Mr. Kaiser?
Thanks, Madam Chair. We have a few points before we finish here. And one is I just wanted to make it clear that the State Solid Waste Administrator Association, we formally call SWA, we are strongly in favor of protecting the groundwater. It is a big part of our job. We agree that more attention needs to be given to landfill siting criteria. And as Annalise said, we like to think that we should have a little bit more time to study just for a little while before we make any decisions. And another point is that we realize that landfills are an important waste management option for counties, and I believe the moratorium suggested by Mr. Steiner in his letter It's a good suggestion, and that would be reasonable in allowing all parties to give this matter some further consideration. And I did want to address a point on the part of the bill that requires liners for landfills accepting industrial waste. According to rules by the PCA, new construction waste, when you're constructing something new, is considered an industrial waste. A lot of the construction and demolition landfills that we fondly call C&D landfills, they would be expected to take the new construction waste, therefore may be required to have an industrial waste management plan. And some of these landfills are not currently lined. A lot of them would be maybe have a hard time surviving if you were to require liners for them, which would lead to more illegal dumping or people not having places to take just regular C&D waste, which basically inert. So we're concerned, the Solidarity Ministers are concerned that might be a result in a shortage of construction, demolition, disposal capacity, a big increase in illegal dumping, and that we do encourage there to be a clearer definition of what is industrial waste, and that a liner rule or a liner statute would take into consideration specific waste streams where the liner would be beneficial in protecting the environment and particularly the groundwater. And that's all I had right now. I'd be happy to take any questions if we'll have any.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Representative Gardner.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and this is for both Mr. Kaiser and Ms. Garlitz. I guess one argument one could make in favor of the bill is that it avoids going through a grueling rulemaking process, and I know that the PCA has had several rulemaking processes for beneficial reuse, the issue of liners and C&D landfills and the like, and I know that at least in one of those cases the process just came to a grinding halt because I think the states or the counties in Greater Minnesota didn't want to do liners and in construction waste landfills. In Wisconsin, they treat it all the same. They have the higher standard. They put construction waste in municipal solid waste landfills. So, and there's stuff like copper chromated arsenic in treated lumber and VOCs and shingles and probably a few other things I can't think of right now. So I guess I was kind of frustrated when I saw that rulemaking process stop on liners for C&D. I just couldn't find a good reason why it would stop on environmental health grounds. So I compliment Representative Bunn for tacking on that part about applying rules to MSW rules for industrial waste landfills. And I suspect that issue will come up again. I know I'm trying to promote recycling of C&D stuff, but we'll still have construction waste landfills. But I think one could make an argument that legislation would be faster and cheaper than a rulemaking process where, depending on how much you trust the rulemaking process, it could just cheater out. So, I still have questions about whether using a tritium test is the right thing to do, but I think relying on the rulemaking process, too, can be a maze that you could never get out of, too. I still would like to see some more consensus among technical experts about the use of this testing regime, and I hope we can get something hammered out, and that was it.
Are there any additional questions to either of these suspects? Mr. Kaiser?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, I'd just like to respond briefly to that. The rulemaking process can be pretty brutal, a lot of bloodletting, but it's been 20 years since this has really been hashed out. Maybe it's time to do that again. One thing about the rules and industrial waste is that it does define waste as being from processes and not exactly what is in the waste stream. I mean, for example, you can take carpeting. Carpeting can fall in several waste streams, as you know, and other things may or may not be inert, may be harmful. Maybe we do need that process and make some hard decisions on how we want to treat certain waste streams and then make some rules that actually fit what we're putting in the ground.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Any other questions? And I thank you very much for reading the letters from others who were not able to be here today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just waiting to see if that's one of the things. Okay.
Okay. Steve Johnson? Is there a Steve Johnson? Welcome to committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm a citizen member of the Sierra Club and active with what's referred to as the St. Croix Valley Interstate Group, which is a group of citizen Sierra Club members who live in both states and are particularly interested in St. Croix Valley and live in that area. I'm also a resident of West Lakeland Township, but I should point out that geologically speaking, I live upslope of this proposed landfill in Washington County, and my groundwater wouldn't be affected. But downslope is the St. Croix River, which is one of five units of the National Park System in Minnesota, and is a National Wild Scenic River, and qualifies as outstanding resource valley water. It has some of the highest water quality of any large river in North America, and the most diverse mussel species populations of any river in North America. I served as the Sierra Club's representative on the Xcel Energy Citizen Task Force that reviewed landfill site options in 2005. I understand that the proposed technology that Xcel Energy would use at this site is as state-of-the-art as one might imagine at this particular point in time. But so the risk of failure of this site and resultant contamination of St. Croix River is probably pretty low. However, I worked for Winona County in the early and middle 1970s when we were closing township garbage dumps throughout the county and urging everyone to use sanitary landfills because that was the state-of-the-art technology at the time and a great solution. And all of those landfills have failed since that time. So I'm a little more cautious as I turn gray about the quality of state-of-the-art technology. What looks pretty good to us now may not look so smart to us in 30 years. And 30 or more years is really the kind of commitment we're talking about here. I'm particularly interested in the fact that in the case of the proposed landfill in Washington County, there is a viable alternative in Rosemont, not that many miles away, that is an existing licensed facility that was evaluated by PCA in the draft EIS, owned by a company called SKV. It's an operating facility that is currently operating, and licensed to take this kind of fly ash. It is already taking this kind of fly ash from, I believe, Hennepin and Ramsey counties, from power plants there. So it would have lower facility preparation costs. There are no real costs associated with preparing the King plant itself to transport ash in a dry form as compared to a wet form. The only higher costs are involved are really is the additional distance to truck the material and the tipping fees that Xcel would have to pay. I'm sorry I don't have any technical expertise in the area of tritium. Everything I know about tritium I just learned this afternoon. Did want to give you a perspective of a group of citizens in the St. Croix Valley that are concerned about this particular landfill proposal and its potential impact on the river. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. And I think that your assessment of the educational component of tritium is shared by a number of people in this room and certainly within this building. So I certainly appreciate your remarks on that. Does anyone have any questions? If not, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time. At this time, I would like to ask, I'm thinking that we need a little bit of clarification on C&D, construction demolition versus industrial waste, some of the definitions. Those are questions that a number of members and other people have asked recently, and since this is informational, I did want to see if we could clarify that, and if Mr. Gary Pulford from the PCA would be able to come and just educate all of us on the differences between construction demolition, how they're cited, rules, etc. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Pulford. I manage a number of solid waste activities at the Pollution Control Agency.
Madam Chair, if I could just ask, if you guys can pull the microphone or lean closer to the microphone, I've been having trouble hearing all the witnesses on this issue.
Good.
Thank you.
With me is Neil Wilson, a senior hydrologist on the staff at the agency. We initially thought we were going to be here today to describe the level of rigor currently that exists under solid waste rules for siting a new landfill in Minnesota. We do have a PowerPoint on that topic, and maybe that would be the place to start, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I would certainly appreciate that. I wasn't aware that you had the PowerPoint, so I'm glad to hear that, and I think that we would appreciate seeing that at this point, if you're ready.
While they're preparing, Representative Loeffler, did you have a question for them at this point?
Madam Chair, and maybe to Mr. Pulford, I serve on the Claims Committee, which had an interesting case brought to us this year in Invergrove Heights in Dakota County, in which the city platted a residential development on top of what had been a former demolition landfill. Actually, I think it was a mixed-use landfill, but the issue that was brought up to Claims Committee was the finding of some debris that had asbestos on it, and there was potential links to the state. But do you also deal with the oversight of what is done after a landfill is closed? I was really surprised that they were allowed to plot that for residential.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are untold numbers of former waste disposal sites scattered around Minnesota. They continue to be unknown. They will be discovered as plats are done and people start digging in the ground. We do have a number of programs at the agency that assist developers and local units of government to investigate, determine risk levels, and help remediate. But I can assure you that there are a good number of sites out there in Minnesota yet that where we buried stuff going back 150 years.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Neil Wilson. I'm a senior hydrogeologist with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Worked there for close to 22 years. I've been working with landfills for about 18. I've worked on pretty much every landfill in the state of Minnesota, including the big ones and small ones. So this evening I'm going to talk about the hydrogeologic requirements for permitting landfills. And basically there are different requirements for the different types of landfills that are out there. There's different requirements for mixed municipal landfills, industrial, combustor ash, and demolition landfills. Madam Chair, what is the usual form for questions? Can I just entertain them as we go, or should we save them to the end?
If you're more comfortable with that, and it works out, that would be fine with me. People can just ask questions as they come up. That would be fine. Thank you.
The general principles for siting landfills in Minnesota is you must adequately characterize prospective sites. Siting may be prohibited or engineered designs may have to be changed to reflect the hydrogeologic conditions, and groundwater monitoring must be required, or considered, I'm sorry. Sometimes, depending on the triggers, an EAW or an EIS is required. An environmental assessment worksheet or an environmental impact statement is required. And the two categories there are what drives into one or the other is given there, but in general, an EIS, if it is required, the process will take longer and potentially more may be required. Talking strictly about probably the more rigorous standards are applied to MSW or mixed municipal landfills. That's just taking household garbage. The rule citation there is given, but for an MSW location, it must be located only where topographic, geologic, and groundwater conditions minimize environmental impacts, soil, bedrock, and groundwater flow has been determined, a monitoring groundwater monitoring system is feasible, and in the event of a release, corrective actions can be taken. MSW landfills cannot be located where hydrogeologic or topographic conditions would allow rapid or unpredictable pollutant migration, impair long-term integrity of the facility, and preclude reliable monitoring. You know, I wasn't sure I was going to be giving this talk. I have handouts. Would anybody like handouts at this point?
Yes, thank you to Pedro. We'll distribute those.
Second here. This might be easier to follow along. In terms of the permitting process, the first step is a potential permittee would submit a permit application, and that's found, the requirements are found in Minnesota Rules 7001-3200, and you'd use existing information to determine the site's geology, groundwater occurrence, horizontal, vertical directions, and rates of movement, and groundwater quality. The detailed site evaluation reports, the rule citations are given, and so a potential permittee must conduct a four-phase in-depth hydrogeologic investigation. In essence, what that is the sequence of work plans and reports that we approve in sequence to get at what is hydrogeologically going on at a site. It's a very rigorous and in-depth process. For the phase one work plan and report, you collate, summarize existing soils, geologic, and hydrogeologic information. This is where, if there was a tritium study that was done, then that possibly would be brought forward as information to be used in decision-making criteria for siting a landfill, what kind of monitoring, what kind of liner, financial assurance, those kind of decisions. For phase two, that's where the intensive site soils and groundwater investigation is done. Phase three is installation of monitoring wells, and phase four is baseline sampling, that which entails three rounds of sampling pretty close together. And the result is, in my opinion, adequate information on siting and monitoring criteria. It's a very thorough approach. What I previously spoke to was mixed municipal landfills, that's household refuse. The hydrogeologic siting requirements for industrial landfills is different and found in a different rule citation. And it's based on the topography, soils, hydrogeologic setting, and potential for harm. And essentially, usually they're viewed as you're going to have to go through the same process as for an MSW landfill. There is some subjectivity to the way the rules are written. I didn't write the rules, just the way they're written. There is some subjectivity to the degree of rigor that's applied, but typically, if you're looking at a new industrial landfill, you're looking at most likely coming up to the MSW rules threshold or criteria. For combustor ash landfills, that's found in that rule citation, and essentially you must complete the same hydrogeologic evaluation for a mixed municipal landfill. For demolition landfills, the rule citation is provided, and the siting liner and hydrogeologic requirements depend on the waste types, soils, and groundwater condition. For demolition landfills, what's come forward is there's a standard class of waste that can be taken, and it's considered class one demolition landfill debris. It's laid out, I think, on our website, and there's guidance as to depending if you go beyond that list to start taking what's classified as industrial waste, then that kicks into what's called class two or class three demolition waste, and there's different siting, monitoring, and liner requirements depending on the class, depending on how much and what kind of industrial waste to take along with what is considered typical demolition debris. In summary, we have robust and effective hydrogeologic study and design criteria already in place in the rules, and as needed, for instance, if an EIS was required, we could require more information such as tritium testing. Having listened to the talk, though, I think really what, let me see here, I think really what seems to be coming forward in what other people are saying and is what our impression here is that basically this comes down to a cost-benefit analysis in terms of the kind of information you get beyond what's already required in the rules. There are questions that technical staff have about this tritium testing. It's not that we'd say that we're adverse to it, but there are questions that remain. For instance, what kind of error bars are associated with testing? You can get errors in sampling analysis. You can also get errors with mixing of different kinds of aquifers. So it's not. I don't think we're adverse to necessarily saying tritium is good or bad or whether it should be used here. There's also a question of how much weight would tritium be given to the final decision on landfill siting. Currently, there is no prohibition on siting a landfill in sand and gravel. It's just that that's the way the rules are written. There is prohibition on siting landfills in karst, but not in sand and gravel. This is kind of a sea change, and maybe it's appropriate. I'm not sure. That's beyond my pay grade. But there's no prohibition on putting a landfill in sand and gravel, but you would need to engineer and monitor around that and make sure that the criteria already set forth is met. And for the most part, it seems like it's pretty sound criteria. So, it almost seems that that is a pretty big decision that people are going to have to work through here, I think. And if I've heard correctly, there's a number of folks that have expressed concern that this process is moving along too quickly. They'd like more time to express their opinion, to be brought up to speed on this. And speaking for the hydrogeologists at the MPCA that work on this, I think that's pretty fair. We need to get more time to get up to speed on this and to figure out whether the cost-benefit is there, what kind of error bar is associated with this, and how much weight tritium should be used in siting landfills, and whether or not all landfills should be completely out of sand and gravel. These are things we really should work through because we're just kind of reacting. We're in a reactive mode instead of more of a measured, informed give and take on this. That's just the way I would see it.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. I believe Representative Portman had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, in the cases where you do have landfills on sandy soils, after the landfills are placed there, do you go out and monitor the groundwater to determine what's getting into it?
Mr. Fulford.
Madam Chair, Representative, maybe a little context would help here. There are 21 landfills permitted in Minnesota to take your garbage and my garbage. MSW landfills, they're all lined with leachate collection systems. There's 106 permitted landfills in the state that accept construction and demolition debris. Approximately one-third of those landfills are lined with leachate collection. The remaining two-thirds are primarily servicing rural Minnesota. There are 40 industrial waste landfills permitted in Minnesota. The majority of those are lined and leachate collection systems. And we haven't sited a new landfill in Minnesota in the last 10 years. So that's just a little context.
Did that answer your question? Or
no, it doesn't. I'm wondering when you have sited and permitted one, if you go back and check, if I'm understanding the terminology correctly, I'm guessing a leachate collection system gathers water off of the site. And so my question is, how often is that tested? And then what you're talking about is permitted and open landfills. I know the state has a number of closed landfills. And I'm wondering if you test groundwater surrounding those sites also.
Madam Chair, Representative, the testing that goes on at the open and operating permitted landfills, both in terms of leachate quality and in terms of groundwater monitoring associated with those sites, is very rigorous. It is conducted for the MSW landfills. Samples are collected from area groundwater monitoring systems 4 times a year, and a suite of compounds as long as your arm is tested for. The second part of your question, I'm sorry.
Closed landfills.
Closed landfills.
Wells surrounding closed landfills. Mr. Pulford.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are 106 landfills. Coincidental, it's the same number as demolition landfills, but be that as it may, there's 106 qualified landfills that the state of Minnesota owns and is taken care of from a leachate management, gas management, and monitoring standpoint.
And so my question is, do you test wells? For example, I grew up in Anoka County on the sand plain around a lot of closed landfills, some of the,
right,
which were Superfund sites, and I'm wondering if the wells in Anoka County have ever been tested.
Madam Chair, Representative, the landfills in Anoka County that are owned by the state of Minnesota are monitored at the same frequency as our open landfills.
I know I'm being a pain in the butt, but I think there's a difference between testing at the site, whether it's the leachate collection system or at the site, and testing wells in the community. And my understanding of what happened in Washington County is that wells in the community became contaminated, I don't know how close to the an actual landfill site or 3M plant that they were, but my understanding is that private wells, not adjacent to, not on the landfill site, is where some problems turn up later. And so my question is, where there are landfills in those areas, are people's private well water ever tested to check and see what's getting out of the landfill and how it's moving through the aquifers? Mr. Pulford.
Madam Chair, Representative, the closed landfill program is, what, some 15 years old now. The monitoring systems and the upgrades of those 106 closed landfills, during the early days of the effort in Minnesota, copious numbers of residential wells were sampled. Now these landfills are being monitored routinely, and that's the sentinel monitoring that would suggest you go to the next layer, which may be, in fact, residential wells that could be impacted.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I did right before I ran for the legislature was worked on closed landfill litigation for a couple of years. And the basis of my question is, do we find that sometimes things get into well water and things get out of landfills that we don't expect? And so I'm curious about, you know, the failure of landfills and whether I'm just very concerned that Representative Bunn's bill is having some tough flooding here, but I think consumers have had some tough flooding when the landfill procedures haven't worked out correctly and either liners have leaked or we haven't done as good of a job as we might have in predicting what the problems would be. And then we end up with problems in wells and pretty hard to put the genie back in the bottle once it's gotten out.
Mr. Pulford.
Chair, Representative, that's why the state of Minnesota decided to take over the ownership of these old first-generation landfills that were established in Minnesota. They are unlined. The leachate is not collected. They have been, we've spent millions and millions and millions of dollars upgrading them. But the generation we're talking about today, the 21 landfills that take care of our garbage, there are night and day differences between those 21 and the 106 the state owns.
Last question. Representative Portman. Of the new state-of-the-art landfills, do we have any where liners have failed? Mr. Pulford.
Madam Chair, Representative, no.
Thank you.
Are there additional questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Popa, this maybe is more an issue for the Department of Health than for you, but I know those of us who are served by municipal water systems pay a water testing fee that I think actually supports more than even our geographic areas testing. And is there a requirement or recommendations that are communicated to people who get their drinking water from private wells to do testing on any kind of regular or periodic basis?
Mr. Pulford.
Madam Chair, Representative, as wells, private wells that could be impacted by one of these 106 landfills that the state owns, there have been advisories to people with drinking water wells in the vicinity of those landfills in the past.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Loeffler, our county checks every well whenever anybody wants to check. They also check it on an annual basis, and the charge is very nominal, if at all. We're very concerned about it. City of Fairmont gets this water right out of the lake. We're very concerned about that. And I think there have been several wells that were contaminated and that we closed. And it's something that the county I live in, that's all I can speak for because that's my world, I guess. They do not routinely, they do it at an at-well basis as well as an annual basis to make sure the water quality is there.
And perhaps if either one of you could address the issue, kind of following up on this particular question, you know, do you have any idea what the rate of testing is? I know when a county tests, it tests for what? Are we testing for nitrates? Are we testing for atrazine? Or, you know, the question is, what are we testing for? Do you have any sense of generally what counties, particularly rural counties, do test for? How many tests? Not a long big discussion of it, but just a general sense.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Pulford.
Actually, no, we don't. I think it'll depend on what part of the state we're talking about and what source of groundwater contamination we might be looking for. If it's in an agricultural area, is it nitrates and atrazine? If it's in an industrial, a former industrial facility and potentially has impact, it may be volatile organic compounds. So I hesitate to suggest that there's any, that at least we're not aware of, any uniform approach across the county.
Thank you, Mr. Pulford. Mr. Wilson?
It probably should be pointed out that all permitted MSW industrial and ash landfills have what's called sentry wells around them. They're monitoring wells that are positioned within 200 feet of the fill, and they're set up such that if there is a release from the facility, it's caught early on so that it never does get to residents in the township. It works, generally speaking, works pretty good. I mean, you ostensibly build these things so that they don't leak. If there is a leak, then you have these sentry wells that are designed to pick up a release. And if so, then the rules are very prescriptive on the actions that need to be taken. There are some dumps and problems out there that we installed waste or don't have direct purview over. So really what all I can speak to is for landfills. There are a number of different programs out there with different sampling frequency and objectives. A lot of times counties do just go after nitrates and bacteria. Many times they do. And so that would be a little different than what you're looking at for landfills.
Thank you. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have kind of a general question for an ordinary landowner who maybe doesn't know if there's any landfills there, but as you state, you know, people dumped a lot of things in the last 50 to 100 years that we may not even know where they were dumping. So just a general person that wanted to have water tested, their well water tested. And I know Dakota County does a lot of this, but some of the other counties don't. Say Ramsey County or Washington County, would they come to you to get their water, well water tested? And and then what would that cost them?
Mr. Pulford.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's usually in the purview of the health department. That would be the first point of contact for an individual resident to suggest that they have some suspicion and they would like to have their well sampled and tested. And I think the health department would, in fact, then provide some direction as to parameters and so on and so forth.
Thank you. Representative Scalzi.
And I've been told that the health department doesn't test well water, so maybe are they then the general gatekeepers, so then they would send the person to you, or do they actually do testing at the health department?
Mr. Pulford.
Madam Chair, Representative, the health department does a horrendous amount of residential well testing. If we talk about the situation in South Washington County, millions of dollars spent on residential well testing.
So then the final part of that question would be, what would the charge be if a homeowner wanted to go to the Department of Health? Do you know what that would cost?
Mr. Pulford.
Madam Chair, Representative, it would all depend on the number of parameters, the number of chemicals you're looking for in the well water.
Are there other questions? If not, I did want to follow up on a couple of things that you had mentioned earlier, and also my initial concern about just explaining the difference between, I know you have that on some of your slides already in your PowerPoint, but, you know, C&D landfills requiring an industrial waste plan, what triggers that. And one other thing about C&D landfills on that subject is you mentioned that we had 106. Was that just coincidentally the same number as landfills owned by the state? Okay. And of that 106 landfills, do you know how many are private and how many are municipally or county owned?
Madam Chair, don't hold me to the exact number, but it's of the 106 demolition landfills permitted in Minnesota, I would venture a guess that 20% are privately owned and operated and 80% are owned by county government primarily.
Thank you, Mr. Pulford. And just a little follow-up on that, do you have any sense of the geographic distribution of the private landfills, where they're sited in the state?
Madam Chair, that you're referring to construction and demolition, right?
Correct.
The distribution of those landfills, privately owned and operated, concentrated in the metropolitan area. The other 80% scattered throughout Minnesota, serving rural residents.
And did you want to, do you have a few more words just on the difference between some of the industrial, you know, what triggers needing an industrial waste plan for a C&D landfill?
Madam Chair, it's up to the proposer. In this case, the majority are county governments. They would propose, as part of their permit to operate a construction and demolition landfill, that they would accept certain industrial waste. We handle that administratively under the permit by embedding in the permit a thing called an industrial waste management plan. In it, we require certain operational standards would be placed on the acceptance and disposal of industrial waste and the monitoring that goes along with a specific industrial waste stream. So that's what triggers an industrial waste management plan is actually the proposer of the landfill or the operator of the landfill.
Thank you. I just have one other question, and this really came about from an earlier question and an earlier testifier. Do you use the MSGS data? I think when we had them speaking, he wasn't sure if you did.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Pulford.
Our experience has been that the rough cut data that MGS, and we applaud their efforts, tackling the whole state in terms of determining its geology and groundwater sensitivity is a horrendous undertaking. But the cut at the level we're seeing today, the level you saw in the pictures, it's the whole state. Many times, when a particular landfill is about to be sited, of which there hasn't been any in 10 years, we're talking 20 acres or 40 acres. So the scales aren't the same.
Thank you. If there are no further questions or comments that you would like to make, I will certainly thank you at this time. And I believe we have someone from DNR Waters at one point in time. Did you have a few remarks? I think your agency was mentioned a few times, and there were some questions about some of the things that you were using or criteria that were you, while you're not citing landfills, but there were some, some hydrogeologic concerns that you might have had regarding this bill. Okay.
Madam Chair, my name is Jan Faltasek. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'm in the Division of Waters. We did last week offer a few technical comments on the language of the bill and the amendment to the bill. Those are being handed out now. Those were previously provided to Representative Bunn. And generally, they follow the same comments you've already heard with Bob Tipping from the Minnesota Geological Survey.
Excuse me one minute. I just wanted to mention that since these are already in the packets, if anyone was wondering why we weren't going any further with them, because we already have those in the packets.
Oh, okay.
But go ahead with your comments. Thank you.
Okay. Generally, one comment I would want to bring up is the fact that the work that we do with the Minnesota Geological Survey is county scale and regional scale. And as Mr. Pulford mentioned, that landfills and similar activities are very local. And of course, you would want to investigate those local sites and determine those site-specific characteristics. It's always appropriate to look for site-specific information. The first comment that we offered is the general shift from reliance on a screening tool to more detailed site-specific information, tritium samples taken at the site or near the site, groundwater samples taken at the site or near the site, and other similar information would be advisable. I've been involved in interpreting the data from the geologic reports and our chemistry sampling that we do for the county atlases for several years, and we do have models that we employ to interpret that information. For example, where is the water table? What is the type of sediment? What is the type of bedrock? And we use that to make interpretations about the potential for pollution sensitivity. We base that on a time of travel of a molecule of water moving from the land surface to an aquifer or a groundwater of interest. And that's on page one. There's a little chart that table one that explains that time of travel. The column on the right shows, according to the time of travel that we employ, tritium may be present in several of those sensitivity categories from very high to moderate. And that is because the time of range of tritium that you might observe ranges from, you might get there very in a very short period of time, or it could take, you know, several decades. And so the time range goes from very high to moderate, and it covers that time range where you might get a particle of water moving through a groundwater of interest. The third comment we had related to this, what appeared to be a development of a new type of, or recasting or a restatement of a sensitivity rating that would be related to landfills. And that's the topic of Table 2. And that's based on the Section C of the amendment to the bill. And we just set up that table to show the comparison between the maps that are currently produced for the County Atlas series using the estimated time of travel and the sensitivity ratings that we apply, and compare that to the language that was proposed in the amendment to the bill. There's a little bit of discrepancy, so there's what I would call a landfill rating, and then there's the geologic rating. There's a little bit of discrepancy, and the comment was that if you use this landfill rating, which was proposed in the bill, that you identify it as such, because they aren't quite parallel. And Bob Tipping, the last item number, item four, I think this was addressed already, and it's already been discussed, about the type of sampling that's done, what parameters are being selected to be analyzed, and also establishing the detection limits and the criteria for those samples to make sure you're getting the data that's necessary. The last comment, number five, suggests that rather than take all this information and then restate it as sensitive or non-sensitive, taking the tritium data and the chemistry information and the other information such as how deep is the aquifer that could be affected, and then combine it to say it's sensitive or non-sensitive, I suggested in the comments that perhaps use a decision tree or a decision matrix to go a step further and restate it as perhaps based on a set of criteria the site would be not suitable, or perhaps there's some information missing, so the step would be some additional information would be required. Another category would be based on a combination of information that the conclusion would be the site would be possibly suitable, but perhaps some additional additional level of management or monitoring might be required. We didn't get an opportunity to flesh out this idea, but it was an option, an idea that might be worth considering. And that's the content of those remarks, or those responses, those comments to the amendment. And I'll take any questions you might have.
Well, seeing no questions, you were very thorough.
Okay.
And I thank you for taking the time to come to this hearing and for pointing out some of the differences and observations that your department had made on this.
Okay.
Thank you. Is Julie Ketchum here? Yep, over there. I think we'll try to be as brief as possible, and understanding that people have perhaps some other commitments this evening, and we certainly started a great deal later than we had anticipated. So I thank you very much. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Julie Ketchum, and I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Waste Management. And with me is Terry Johnson. He's the Director of Groundwater Protection for Waste Management. And we testified two other times on this bill and provided some technical comments. We still have some technical background that we'd like to provide to this committee. We echo many of the sentiments that have been expressed here tonight on the rulemaking, and the detail in this bill really looks more like rule language that you would go through the PCA process to, you know, have a broad stakeholder group take a look at that. So I won't repeat all of that. But in the past testimonies that Waste Management provided, we did prepare a memo. That memo has been passed out. And we're going to go a bit beyond the memo that you've had and kind of go into the background levels that are in the bill currently, or the test level, the 5 tritium units. And our question is, why five tritium units? And from Mr. Tipping's testimony, he said that 5 tritium units was taken from the Ottawa study, and we still believe that that's an arbitrary number for Minnesota. It's not testing that was based in Minnesota. And Terry's going to go into a lot of the difficulty with establishing a background level for Minnesota. And then once you establish that background level, you can then establish a test level in the legislation or in rule or whatever. But a background level really needs to be established first, and Terry's going to kind of go into why it is difficult to do that for tritium in particular. And secondly, Terry's going to talk a little bit about the language in the bill and some of the confusion and differences that and issues that are in that bill. And then he'll also talk about the protection that's currently provided at current landfill sites.
Thank you, Julia. Madam Chair, my name is Terry Johnson. I'm a professional geologist in Minnesota. I work for Waste Management as a director of the Groundwater Protection Program, and I have about 40 landfill facilities within my area of coverage. I did take a look at the bill kind of from a technical perspective of someone that would be tasked with complying with the bill in the event of siting a new facility. And I'll try to be brief. But with regards to the background levels in tritium, as we saw earlier in testimony from Mr. Tipping, the Ottawa has a well-established record of tritium values, but tritium values elsewhere in the U.S., as I understand it, a lot of the tritium testing has been discontinued in the U.S. It does vary spatially. I don't know that we can safely assume that the levels in Ottawa are similar to the levels in Minnesota. I know some of the information I was able to obtain indicates that levels in St. Louis were around 3 tritium units, Idaho was near 8, and so we've got a lot of spatial variability, and then tritium also varies with time. So I think before we move forward with something like this, we really need to understand what the background levels in tritium are in Minnesota before we put a number in and hold everyone to that number. Some of the specifics of the bill that we have questions on, early on in the bill, it specifies 150 feet of non-aquifer material, but there's really no definition of what that is. What is non-aquifer material? Why is it 150 feet? Why isn't it not 50 feet? We're left with a lot of questions. There's enriched tritium units in the bill. I don't know what that unit is. There's an enrichment process that you go through in testing for tritium, but there's not a unit called the enriched tritium unit in my experience. And I think the part of the bill that we were most concerned with is on the end of Section C, where we've heard that the definition or for the purpose of this section, highly sensitive to groundwater contamination means a travel time water from the land surface to the water table or bedrock is less than 20 years. I think we've heard the MGS testify that they're confident it's 50 years, but with the bill we have 20 years, but now we're not talking about distance from the land surface to an aquifer, we're talking about distance from the land surface to the water table, which is a completely different idea, and that perhaps is where the MTCA's concerns came about this being used to prohibit landfilling pretty much everywhere in Minnesota, because the water table is everywhere in Minnesota, and it is very shallow, and it is likely treated. So these are just a couple of the technical questions. We're not suggesting they're not unresolvable, but we have a lot of questions here on this important legislation. So, and then in addition, the bill has provisions for calibrating to tritium background as we go forward, and that in it of itself is a difficult task, in that being it is spatially variable and temporally variable, we would need to employ some sort of statistical test. We need to have perhaps more than one station in Minnesota to do that. There's a lot of details that would need to be worked out that have important implications to how this would be applied to future facilities. And I think, you know, I've listened to a lot of the questions, and it seems like a discussion is needed on if what we're trying to do here is eliminate all future disposal facilities, regardless of what we can do from an engineering perspective in sand units. And if that's really what we want to do, then that discussion needs to be, and I think MPCA and others and MGS have made that point, so that's a discussion that needs to occur. And I think there's two sides to that issue. Having worked on a lot of older unlined landfills and modern landfills, some of the landfills that have been older and unlined that are in sand units are some of the most ideal locations, because they may be in close proximity to a surface water body. You can easily cut off the groundwater down gradient to that unit with a simple excavating a trench and run it through a treatment system. Whereas if you site these in more complicated geology, you often have to do everything remotely using holes. I'm not advocating one way or the other, but I think we really need to have that discussion. So that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Are there any questions? Oh, Representative Gardner.
Well, this is a question from Mr. Johnson. I was hoping you were from Houston, actually, so that we could make a joke about the weather, but I see you're from here. Could you tell me about just how other states do this? I know that Wisconsin mixes C&D and MSW. Iowa may do things different. I know you've got Kansas, too, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but if you could just give us some comparison about how this kind of issue is set up. Are we tougher? Are we more lenient? What's the deal?
I think Minnesota probably has more stringent regulations with regard to landfilling.
Good answer.
Than some of the surrounding states. Subtitle D was promulgated, and you know Minnesota went to US EPA and basically made the case that our program is more stringent. They laid it out line by line, and that document is available, and MPCA approved their program. So, you know, in terms of C&D material versus MSW material, it's variable. Wisconsin actually regulates facilities based on size with regard to C&D too. So it's the volume of material, if it's smaller versus larger, there's a more stringent regulation. So.
Thank you. Are there any other additional questions? If not, thank you very much. And I believe we have just two more testifiers, both with Excel. So if they wanted to come together, and again, since you have had the opportunity to give this testimony, and I think all except Representative Hortman has heard this, we'll be as brief as possible. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
My name is Rick Evans. I'm with XL Energy, and I'm only here to answer the simple questions. So if you don't ask simple questions, I won't say much more, except for Mr. Representative Gunther, I imagine. But we did, knowing that this committee wanted to look at a statewide policy issue. This is not the same testimony that we gave at the other committees. Rather, we tried to look at the broad policy, and I'm going to let Mr. Donkers handle that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Chuck Donkers. I'm a licensed geologist in Minnesota. I've been working with landfills for over 16 years in the state at all of our industrial waste landfills. I've been reviewing the proposed bill, and I basically have five points. So far the bill has gone through limited technical review. Many of these issues can be easily resolved. There are others that are asking more questions. The implications of the bill are still unknown. Environmental benefits are questionable. This bill does not recognize principles of risk management, and the need for this bill really hasn't been documented. They've been citing historic cases, and as Mr. Pulford has stated, the new landfill is a totally different design, and we should not be comparing to the old unlined landfills. This bill has received a limited technical review, and it's evident in many ways. First, they propose the interpretation of a simple tritium test, and that's ambiguous. It can be very ambiguous, and thus it's a poor criteria by itself. It doesn't account for mixing of old and new water. They recognize that it exists, but they don't specify how to address it. They don't, you know, for instance, the leaky aquifer, recharging overlying aquifer with older water can dilute it out. It does not account for horizontal travel times. We see at one of my sites I have horizontal travel velocities of 1,500 feet per year, and another site is 30 feet per year. So that the age of the water beneath the site can vary tremendously. And also, it's acknowledged that the underlying water or old water can be viewed as high or low tritium values. Okay, both of them can reflect old water. Okay, and also of significance, the bill is kind of inconsistent in how it's defined highly sensitive areas. The bill defines it as a highly sensitive area, an area to be excluded for permitting, as having an infiltration rate of less than 20 years. The DNR defines a 20-year infiltration rate as moderately sensitive. And then also in the bill, they establish a tritium criteria of 5 tritium units, which is 50% of the current precipitation, which is approximately 10. And this is based off of the Ottawa data. And that is equivalent to one half-life of tritium, which is 12 years. So the standard, they're saying all of them equate to highly sensitive. And it's mixed. It's inconsistent. Another aspect, I think, is probably looking at some of the possibilities or some of the scenarios. Looking at it from a sensitive or not sensitive aspect can be misleading. We can foresee a site where the infiltration time is more than 20 years to go from the ground surface to the water table. However, the first thing you do in landfill construction is to excavate out. And if you excavate through that impeding layer, maybe you circumvent that, and what you thought and allowed siting for based on a non-sensitive area could actually be a rapid infiltration time or a short time to hit the water table. And I have a diagram of that, and I'll show later. And also, I just want to say it is a very complex system, for siting a landfill. And we did establish a 2005 Citizens Committee for siting a landfill in Washington County. And they acknowledged the complexities basically by identifying at least 21 criteria that should be considered in siting a landfill. And as we've heard many times over, there is a procedure for a formal rulemaking to review and to establish technical criteria, and I highly recommend that. I think there are many angles and aspects of this that need to be discussed. The full impact of this legislation is unknown. As Mr. Tipping stated, there are approximately or portions of 29 counties that have been mapped for sensitivity, and we do not have a truly comprehensive tritium database. There are many questions as far as what depth in the aquifer was the water sample collected for tritium analysis, and the deeper in the aquifer, the older the water. So there's some questions about that and how it relates. So we cannot really quantify the impact other than at a very gross level low resolution mapping. Another aspect that is somewhat overlooked is that the bill mandates the application of MSW rules to industrial waste landfills, and I feel that this is inappropriate. Industrial waste is generated by both manufacturing and non-manufacturing activities. So you'd be regulating industries such as sugar beet processing, because that waste goes to an industrial landfill. Energy from biomass, ethanol production, all of these things would be affected by this bill. The environmental benefit of this bill is somewhat questioned. The bill would encourage, if a landfill is prohibitive, the bill would encourage trucking our waste greater distances and thus creating more greenhouse gases. And also, the major landfills in operation today that are most likely targeted to receive waste from a metro facility are currently sited in sensitive or very sensitive geology. So, and they would have a similar designed landfill as currently proposed by Excel. So we're not sure of the benefit. Another angle, we feel that a 30-year lag time, or the time to infiltrate from the ground surface to the water table, 30 years, the impact is no better than if it were a 5-year lag time. The goal is to have no release, or to prevent a release from the landfill. And then the conditions, the geologic conditions that inhibit or impede the infiltration may work against you in the sense that you'll have more difficulty in monitoring and more difficulty in remediating a site. So here, what makes a site less sensitive may not actually benefit you in the long run. The next is the principles of risk management has not been recognized by this bill. The risk is a summation of all the parts. The landfill design, the operation of the landfill, the material that's disposed, and siting. And the siting not only should address infiltration time, but also it should address the ability to monitor and the ability to remediate. So it's one component. We agree with that. And the sensitivity maps, in my experience, have been used in the sense that they have driven additional hydrogeologic investigations and a more in-depth evaluation of monitorability and remediation. And it has led to more stringent liner designs proposed. And those are ways of making amends for a more sensitive site. And finally, our question is, for this bill, where is the problem? many of the examples cited for the need of this bill predate our current operation style. The landfills were unlined, groundwater monitoring was not required, and to use those as a benchmark saying landfilling is poor science is inappropriate. The modern landfill, the composite line landfill, is designed to collect leachate. It's designed to shut off infiltration so leachate generation is stopped. And it's always with the mindset of looking for a release and having a plan in place to remediate it if it is detected. And as Mr. Pulford had stated, there's been no evidence documenting a groundwater impact from one of these modern facilities. I believe the process is working. As I said, the aquifer sensitivity is consideration and has led to more stringent liner designs in our experience and a more complete investigation and analysis of monitorability and remediation. I guess the last two pages of this handout are some figures, and I guess I just kind of like to toss them out just as a discussion point to kind of highlight some ideas. The first one is, figure one is a low sensitive, a site that could be considered low sensitivity. It would have an infiltration time of in excess of 20 years, and that could be due to a clay strata. However, as I alluded to earlier, the first thing you do in a landfill is to excavate. And if you happen to excavate out through that clay layer, now there is no layer that's going to impede infiltration. And as the numbers here are just kind of fictitious, 6 and 30 years, but it's just meant to illustrate that the retarding layer of the clay is lost, even though it was sited in a non-sensitive area. Another aspect is if you have a very thick aquifer, travel times can be very horizontal travel times can be very slow. An example is at our Sherco site, which is in a sensitive area. It's 30 feet of saturated sand, and the travel there is on the order of 500 feet or more per year. However, we go down into a bedrock valley where we now have 150 feet of saturated sand, and the groundwater travel velocity is much, much slower. And the time to travel across the facility is now measured in decades and not in years. And so the time to a receptor is much longer. We do have plenty of time to monitor and to remediate in that situation. And then the final case is, and this is kind of where the debate comes in, it's one of the other side of the fence, figure three. It would be a scenario which is mapped as low sensitivity, where it would take longer than 20 years to infiltrate. And here, if it was a thick layer of clay, it may take decades to travel down, slow lateral velocities. By the time you get to your down gradient side, you may be talking 50 years before any contaminant would be picked up. 50 years, by that time, your landfill has been filled. Your 20 years of post-closure monitoring almost complete. You've turned off the light, you know. And in that case, that's an area that needs to be discussed, I guess. That's not to say after 50 years you may not have picked up a plume. Maybe it has yet to arrive. This bill does not address that. So that's why I think a more detailed technical review is warranted. And that's it for my presentation, and I answer questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Well, we certainly appreciate your further research that you did, kind of beyond the earlier things that were presented to the committees. So if there are no questions, I thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Gunther.
What would happen? I'll call you Mr. Geologist.
Okay.
What would happen if we had an extraordinary high water event in Washington County, and we had 10 inches of rain. What would happen to the travel time of these things?
Mr. Donker.
Madam Chair and Representative Spencer. The lateral travel velocity
mm-hmm.
can be pretty much the same.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It may infiltrate slightly faster due to a slug of water coming through and more of a saturated condition, a wetting front coming through. But the horizontal travel velocity will be pretty consistent, not changing much.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. The same high water event would probably be the same for any sensitivity for any landfill, is that correct?
Mr.
Doctor.
Madam Chair and Representative Gunther. I should almost preface it with a little bit. At the site I've studied, if groundwater was traveling through fractured rock, where it was this secondary porosity that is the main mode of travel, it would be much more rapid and much more flashy. So it almost comes back to a case-specific scenario. At our existing Molter pit, or the King Landfill in Oak Park Heights, the aquifer is water table aquifer is an unconsolidated sand and silt. That is much less flashy in terms of changes in gradient, and is more predictable. If it were in a fractured karst, it can be a different scenario as far as how it responds to a 10-inch rain event. Once that rain event, and one of the benefits there is once the rain event is over, it settles back down quite quickly, but there is a brief period when it's erratic. In terms of our proposed landfills, are you alluding towards that, or you want to look at that, consider that case?
I haven't thought of it, but go for it.
That site is considered equivalent to a forest media, where it's acting like our other sites, unconsolidated material, and not flashy, predictable, gradients are consistent. We've monitored groundwater elevations at that site hourly for over 2 years, and we've never seen a significant change in gradient or flow direction.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Bunn, I think you had some final comments, and also your testifier that you were reserving here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to all of you here and in the audience for your patience today and this later evening. Just a couple response comments to some of the remarks that were made earlier. In terms of the issues raised by the counties and the Solid Waste Association made some good points. On the issue of, I just want to briefly hit a couple of those. On the issue of re-permitting or reissuing possibly a permit, that is something we will look more closely at to make sure the bill language accommodates that issue because they are re-permitted every 5 years, I understand. And so if that is what's being referred to, we'll make sure we address that head on and work with PCA to address that more clearly. Second, the issue of classification of industrial waste, that's in paragraph F. I think given the discussion about C&D waste and the various tiers and levels and that they can have industrial waste plans, we will seek further clarification of that and make sure we understand that in the context of the bill. It was mentioned about a couple times about tritium, concerns about tritium as a sole criteria. Again, it's an initial screening criteria, and paragraph C assures it's not the sole criteria. In this process, I want to clarify that it's not a sole criteria. Moving on then to a few comments made by PCA, and we appreciate their input in this. In general, about the issue of the adequacy of the existing rules, I think just to clarify what the distinction is between what we're proposing and the existing rule process, particularly the considerable rules that exist for MSW waste, is that in the end, as is true in this particular case with the West Lakeland situation, well, that's industrial rules, While, you know, sensitivity issues may be looked at or considered, in the end, in fact, not a single non-highly sensitive site was considered for disposal in that situation in the environmental review process. So our issue is that, you know, a process that only looks at highly sensitive sites, you know, has some flaws. Moreover, that if there are alternatives to highly sensitive sites and just engineering the solution rather than starting with some inherently more protective situation, we're saying in this legislation we think we should err on the side of starting with a more protective situation. Granted, the engineering has come a long way, but as you've heard me mention in other testimony, our concern is there's only a 20-year track record on the current technology, that that's not sufficiently long, at least for my community, to suggest that we should rely only on, primarily in this case, on the engineering approach to addressing the highly sensitive issue. In addition, in specific, in this particular case, the critique of the environmental impact statement, there were three different engineering consulting firms that wrote critiques and remarks for the EIS process, draft EIS process. They're all available on the website at the PCA. All of them are raised some significant criticisms of the hydrological and groundwater modeling and potential release of a contaminant modeling in those in that report. So we're concerned about, number one, whether the state of the art in terms of modeling these things is really protective of us, and number two, whether the technology itself is protective of us over the long haul, etc. And moreover, that if such a release does occur, we are not convinced that one can necessarily remediate these situations. We've had many discussions in many committees this year, particularly with PFCs and other issues, that sometimes one can't particularly remediate the situation after it's occurred. It's in the water systems and not necessarily fixable in an easily observable, an easy way. The bottom line, this really comes down to the issue of protecting groundwater, protecting drinking water. I want to draw your attention now in terms of just to give a little response to, on the West Lakeland thing. In your packet is a two things from West Lakeland Township. We're not going to spend time on that specific issue, but I would draw your attention to have you look at the one, particularly from Mr. Casey, that's included there, and cites these issues I just alluded to, why only highly sensitive sites. And then a third point that I haven't yet mentioned, which is, in this kind of community, if we in fact do have such a pollution release at some point in time, despite the good new technology, there's really no other options for drinking water. They are not highly dense areas. There's no public systems. It would just be difficult to install any public systems because there's no density of housing. And so they are fully reliant on the groundwater for their drinking water with few alternatives to them in any future. So that's why it's a great concern. In addition to the Casey article, there's also one from Mr. Getty. He is one of the township supervisors in West Lakeland Township, and so you're welcome to read his remarks. But with me today, if you would like to say a few remarks, is the chair of the West Lakeland Township board, and he may just like to briefly stress one or two of the points that's also touched on in Mr. Getty's comments. If you'd like. If not, we can end it today.
I came all this way. I might as well say something.
Okay. Welcome to committee, and please identify
and
yourself for the record.
And everything else that everybody will have to leave in. But
I will.
Good evening, Madam Chairman, representatives, committee members. My name is Dan Killo, and I'm the chairman of the Board of Supervisors for the West Lakeland Township, a small community east of St. Paul in the scenic St. Croix River Valley. Our township is very much in favor of this bill. We, like most Minnesotans, cherish all our water resources, and specifically our groundwater. Sadly, too often in the past, landfills have been located where it has been most convenient and economical for landowners and dumpers, with little or no regard for the geologic makeup of the land beneath them or the harsh economic consequences to others. Our community, along with many of our neighboring communities such as Lake Elmo, Baytown, Lakeland, Woodbury, Afton, have been victim of several past landfill accidents, resulting in several groundwater contaminant plumes within our community. There are approximately 2,000 to 3,000 or more private wells within these communities drawing drinking water for our residents from underground aquifers in highly sensitive areas. And because the homes and wells are widely spread out, as Representative Vaughn had indicated, any groundwater contamination that would require installing a city-type water system would be cost prohibitive to our residents. Statewide, there are increasing signs of our surface waters becoming tainted from atmospheric pollutants such as mercury in northern Minnesota lakes. This should further serve to underline the importance of taking steps to eliminate any risk taking when it comes to our groundwater. Here is the case where erring on the side of safety has little or no downside for the good of our communities, whereas erring on the side of risk, taking based on claims from those opposing this bill, has great potential for resulting in dire and expensive consequences. We realize that waste of any kind needs to be disposed of, and we create some of that waste ourselves. But reasonable precautions taken now will alleviate and prevent consequences in the future. Locating landfills in areas where soil makeup and bedrock formations are less susceptible to contamination just makes common sense. You have heard from many who oppose this bill, but many of these people may not be around for 20, 30, or 50 years in the future to explain or pay for the consequences if they are wrong. In my role as a township board member, I rely heavily on knowledgeable experts regularly, and if you are like me, we are not experts on heavy technical data. However, there are times when we must rise and look at the big picture and apply common sense. Whereas emerging technology regarding safety of landfills is promising, it is not long-term tested. Mother Nature will overcome all things sooner or later. It is no longer acceptable to accept so-called solutions that only reach out 10, 20, 50, or even 100 years, and to pass the buck to the future generations. Representative Vaughn's bill addresses this issue in a logical way, and we urge your support. Thank you much for your time. And if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Kilo. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for taking the time to come and present your remarks to the committee. And Representative Vaughn, do you have any final comments?
One last point. I wanted Bob Tipping to respond to one comment made by Waste Management about the spatial issue of background for tritium. He had one comment to make about that. Just a point of clarification before we wrap it up.
Madam Chair.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Tipping.
Two memos came from Waste Management with regard to background levels, and the second memo with the St. Louis data, I don't really have the memo in front of me, but for the dates that they mentioned, the average tritium value, I believe, was 11, not 3, as recorded here. Secondly, the measurements that came from Idaho Falls were reported here as 8. In the memo issued by them, I think it was 28, and that site is located near a nuclear facility. So again, the context of this data has to be taken in where it came from. We do recognize that average background levels do fluctuate annually. Given the chart and what we go on by Ottawa, we're assuming here in Minnesota that those values do average out on an annual basis.
Representative McNamara.
So what's this location of the two nuclear plants that we have, how does that affect this potentially?
It certainly adds to atmospheric tritium. Again, what you're measuring, the analogy is useful is to look at daily temperature as opposed to ongoing annual average temperature. The average temperature in Minnesota is probably around 50 degrees. We're assuming based on the Ottawa trend, where they also have nuclear facilities, that the average atmospheric value is somewhere right now around 8 to 12.
Representative McNamara.
So do we take into account whatever variable may occur, or could there be variables? Is there different things they do at the at the nuclear power plants that could affect, and do we have a way of measuring that, or is there no difference in variability? Does it matter?
Between...
Mr. Tipping.
In regards to the level, can it be affected by anything they do different, and or does it never change?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Tipping.
I don't know the processes exactly or the levels that are emitted from a nuclear facility. I do know from the data reported by Waste Management, at least, that there are examples of measurements taken near or downwind of nuclear facilities that would be higher than the annual average level for that region, say for the state of Idaho. So locally, you can have an effect of enriched tritium in measurements. Regionally, more in the state, I don't believe, in my experience, that you'd see those same high values.
Representative McNamara.
So you're saying it doesn't matter the distance of how far this is away from a nuclear plant or what they're doing at the nuclear plant?
How far the measurement is taken?
How far, for instance, the West Lakeland site is?
The use of the Madam Chair, the use of the tritium in this bill is to treat it as a statewide average. And again, assuming that statewide average is somewhere between 8 and 12 tritium units, then that applies to anywhere in the state, not specifically to the Lakeland site.
Okay.
Representative McNamara.
But my question would be, so we're using it statewide.
Mm-hmm.
What if, does it matter when it's closer to a nuclear site? I mean, is it going to matter? We're not doing anything different if the site's in Red Wing or West Lakeland or in Halleck, Minnesota, that's 400 miles away from a power plant, or 350 in the case of Monticello.
Madam Chair, if I understand your question now, I think I do, that the concentrations in precipitation or in surface water near these sites would be higher than they would be somewhere that's farther away from a nuclear facility.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience, I don't know how to answer that. I don't believe that they would be, but I don't have the data to back that up.
Mm-hmm. Are there any further questions? Representative Bond.
One last technical thing, and I believe it was Waste Management, the other testifiers, they mentioned that paragraph C, we used the word enriched instead of tritium there. We did realize that was an appropriate use of it in that paragraph, and we had planned to exit out, as you see in my notes. So we caught that one. So another technical correction.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Bond. Mm-hmm. If there are no further questions, we will conclude. And I just would like to say that the information and questions, I think, that have been coming in really point out the fact, the thing that has impressed me is that it seems like whether you talk with solid waste professionals, agency staff and professionals, whoever throughout this, there seem to be more questions than answers. And I thank Representative Bund for her willingness to look at some of the far-reaching ramifications, and certainly thank her for bringing up the issue of landfill siting. For since we haven't really addressed this issue comprehensively since 1988, perhaps it's time to open that up again and take a look at it. And looking at it in a very thorough, methodical manner that allows a stakeholders group to take a good, serious look at how we're going to work at finding a place to put the stuff we don't want, you know, how are we going to do that, and at the same time protect our groundwater, because once that is contaminated, it certainly is a horrendously expensive proposition, if even possible, to remediate. But There certainly are those questions with, particularly with the C&D landfills. And Representative Bunn and I have had a number of conversations on this, and I thank her very much for her willingness to look at some of the issues aside, you know, primarily with C&D. So thank you all for taking the time to come today, and good luck on the drive home. I'm sorry if you're driving home in a lot of snow, but... Anyway, so thank you very much for attending the informational hearing. Thank you.